Welcome to the Deep Dive, the show where we take a stack of information and extract the most important nuggets of knowledge to help you become instantly well-informed.
That's the goal.
Today, we're plunging into a topic that, believe it or not, touches almost every single one of us, whether you own property, care for an animal, or just walk down a public street.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking crimes against property and the fascinating, sometimes surprisingly complex, world of trespassing.
Yeah, it sounds simple on the surface, doesn't it?
It really does. Okay, let's unpack this. When we talk about property rights and boundaries, it might sound like something you learned in a civics class, maybe a bit dry, but the nuances are truly captivating and have profound real-world implications. It's really the bedrock of how our society defines what's mine and what's yours, you know?
Absolutely. And how those lines are protected. What's fascinating here, looking at our sources today, which are several chapters of legal code, really detailed stuff.
Right. Chapters 28, 30, and 42 specifically. Yeah,
exactly. What's fascinating is how these legal frameworks categorize and define offenses against property and even against living beings.
It's not just a blanket, don't steal, don't break stuff.
Not at all. They meticulously detail everything from the broader categories of property crimes right down to specific offenses like arson, criminal mischief, various forms of animal cruelty, and of course the intricate rules around different types of trespass.
And we're going to explore not just what the laws say.
Right, but the why behind these distinctions. Why does the law treat damaging, say, a simple fence differently than damaging a public utility?
Or why are some animals protected more stringently than others?
Precisely. These laws don't just outline the act itself. They consider critical factors like intent, that's a big one, the value involved, and the specific circumstances that dramatically change an offense's severity.
So it's about understanding the foundational principles that protect both property and public safety.
Exactly, the why behind it all.
That's why this deep dive is so crucial. Our mission for you today is to clarify these often complex legal definitions and distinctions.
Mm-hmm.
We're here to provide a foundational understanding for anyone new to the topic, highlighting the key elements that transform, you know, a simple act into a serious offense, and illustrating their impact with details drawn directly from the legal code.
Making it accessible.
Yeah. So whether you're just generally curious about how these laws work, perhaps you're a new homeowner navigating property rights, or you're looking to understand specific situations related to animals or public spaces, we're here to guide you through it.
We'll try.
We'll make sure you gain a solid grasp without getting bogged down in impenetrable legal jargon. We're going to build a clear picture, piece by piece, helping you become truly well-informed on a topic that really does affect everyone.
Sounds like a plan.
Okay, so first up, when we think about property offenses, it's easy to picture a generic criminal. Just one type of person.
Right. The sort of movie bad guy.
Exactly. But the truth is, not all offenders are the same, especially when it comes to property crimes. The legal system and law enforcement really benefits from understanding how they operate and what drives them.
Oh, absolutely. It changes everything.
Knowing these distinctions isn't just an academic exercise. It offers incredible insights into the patterns of criminal behavior and, crucially, the challenges faced by law enforcement. It sounds like knowing the who can sometimes be as important as the what, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. It changes how you approach prevention, investigation, even prosecution. It's fundamental. So let's start with what our sources describe as the professional criminal or professional thief.
Okay, professional. That sounds serious.
It is. And when you hear that, you might picture, like you said, a master burglar from a movie, and you wouldn't be far off.
Right.
These individuals are driven primarily by a clear profit motive. This isn't some impulsive act. It's a calculated business venture for them.
So it's their job, essentially.
In a criminal sense, yes. Their operations are meticulously designed to minimize any chance of observation. They work very hard to avoid eyewitnesses. They want to be completely unseen, unheard.
Stealth is key.
Crucial. And to achieve this level of stealth, their actions require significant planning, precise direction, and refined operating skills. This isn't spontaneous. It's often a carefully executed plan, often showing a surprising degree of sophistication.
So they're not just grabbing something and running. They've thought through every step. That's a stark contrast to what many might imagine when they hear thief.
A huge contrast.
So if they're so meticulous, what's their biggest blind spot, or where does the system typically catch up with them? Is there a weak link?
That's a great question. And it brings us to what the sources identify as their Achilles heel, the disposal of the stolen property.
Ah, getting rid of the loot.
Exactly. They might be brilliant at acquiring the goods, but moving them discreetly, converting them into cash without being caught, that's their biggest vulnerability. This is where law enforcement often finds their leverage.
Makes sense.
And the type of property stolen is often a crucial clue here, because these thieves frequently specialize in specific goods that are easier to convert into cash on the black market.
Like what? High-end electronics, jewelry.
Yeah, exactly. High-end electronics, jewelry, specific car parts items with a ready, if illicit, market.
Right, because if they're caught with the goods or if the goods are traced back to them, the whole enterprise crumbles.
Precisely.
So how do they typically offload these items if it's such a weak point? Who are they selling to?
They almost always work in conjunction with criminal receivers, more commonly known as fences.
The middleman.
Essentially, these are individuals or networks who regularly receive and dispose of stolen goods, effectively laundering them into legitimate currency or other assets. Think of it as their specialized shadowy distribution network.
So the thief steals, the fence sells.
That's the typical model. The professional thief focuses entirely on the acquisition, while the fence handles the illicit market. This symbiotic relationship means that while the professional thief is incredibly hard to catch in the act,
Because they're so careful.
their reliance on fences creates a critical point of vulnerability for law enforcement. If you can identify and take down the fence, you can often trace it back to multiple professional thieves.
Ah, okay. Cutting off the distribution network.
Exactly. And it's important to note that these professionals aren't limited to just one type of theft. They are often involved in a range of property crimes, including burglary, sophisticated white-collar crimes, vehicle theft, agricultural crimes.
Wow, diverse portfolio.
Indeed. And they might even resort to arson if it serves their profit-driven objectives, perhaps to destroy evidence or collect insurance.
Always about the money.
Always. Their overarching goal is always to outwit officers, to be smarter and more elusive, rather than resorting to violence, which could escalate their charges and increase their risk profile. They prefer to stay in the shadows.
That makes a lot of sense. They're playing a long game, trying to avoid detection and confrontation. But not all property offenders fit that mold, do they? It sounds like they're the intellectual heavyweights of the criminal world in a way.
You could say that. They rely on planning and skill.
Let's transition to a different type then, one that can often be much more unpredictable and potentially dangerous.
Indeed. Next, we have what the sources describe as the semi-professional, unskilled thief.
Semi-professional, unskilled. Okay, that paints a picture.
The very name tells you there's a different dynamic at play. While profit is still their underlying motive, it's almost always for immediate needs, like money for drugs or basic necessities.
So more desperation driven.
Very often, this immediate, desperate need changes their calculus significantly. Their targets are determined more by sheer opportunity than meticulous planning.
Right place, right time, wrong reason.
Exactly, which is why they're sometimes referred to as a cruising robber. They're quite literally cruising, looking for an easy, available target, a moment of vulnerability, rather than planning an elaborate heist.
So less premeditation, more impulse, often driven by a pressing immediate need.
Exactly. They are far less involved in planning or preparation compared to their professional counterparts. This lack of foresight often makes their actions less predictable, more chaotic. They're also described as less rational, and this is precisely where the danger comes in.
Less rational. How so?
This diminished rationality means they are much more likely to resort to violence against a victim, especially if they are interrupted, surprised, or cornered during the commission of their crime.
Ah, fight or flight, and they might choose fight.
Precisely. They present a special danger when interrupted, precisely because of their propensity for violence, viewing it as their primary means to effect an escape, even if it's not the most rational choice.
That's a stark contrast to the professional who wants to avoid violence and higher charges at all costs. It sounds like a much more volatile, immediate, and potentially life-threatening situation for anyone who encounters them.
Absolutely. The professional thief relies on their cunning. The semi-professional might rely on brute force and desperation when cornered. It's a fundamental difference in their approach and the level of risk they pose to the public.
Okay, so professional, semi-professional. What's next?
Now let's move to a type of offender that uniformed officers encounter even more frequently: street thieves.
Street thieves. Okay, I can imagine. What characterizes them and how do they differ from the semi-professional type we just discussed?
Well, street thieves often carry weapons and take incredibly reckless chances to avoid apprehension.
Weapons and recklessness, not a good combo.
Not at all. This immediately sets them apart from the professional. who meticulously avoids weapons to keep charges lower. Unlike the semi-professional who might be looking for any easy target, street thieves usually steal for trading material to procure narcotics or alcohol.
So the motive is very specific and immediate, feeding an addiction.
Very direct. Their immediate, often intense need for substances drives their impulsive and particularly dangerous behavior.
So a very direct and urgent correlation between the theft and their addiction. This sounds like they're acting out of pure desperation, which can be incredibly dangerous.
Precisely. They are identified as the most dangerous auto thieves, largely because of their desperation and willingness to use violence or take extreme risks to escape capture.
More dangerous than the professional stealing cars.
In terms of immediate public safety risk during the act or apprehension, yes. Uniformed officers, because of their constant presence on the streets and the responsiveness to immediate calls, encounter street thieves far more frequently than the highly elusive professional car thief.
Right, the pros are trying not to be seen.
Exactly. The professional, as we discussed, tries to outwit the officer, focusing on their mental game and meticulous planning. The street thief, driven by immediate needs and often under the influence, is far more likely to engage in dangerous confrontations or high-speed chases.
Makes sense.
Their desperation and willingness to use violence make them a significant public safety concern, often posing an immediate threat to anyone nearby.
It's clear how these different motivations lead to such distinct approaches, levels of sophistication, and crucially, levels of danger. Okay, we've laid out these three distinct types of thieves: professional, semi-pro, street thief. But where do burglars, who often seem to combine elements of both, fit into this typology? Are they their own category or high?
That's a fantastic question, because burglars are indeed a distinct category in law enforcement, but they share a lot of common ground with the professional thief, particularly when it comes to their profit motivation.
Okay, so it's still about the money.
Primarily. They're not just breaking in at random. They're looking for valuable items that can be quickly and easily converted into cash. A key characteristic of a burglar is their specific ability to gain entry to premises, often by stealth or by defeating locks and alarms.
So there's a skill involved: lockpicking, bypassing systems.
Yes, this isn't just opportunistic. It requires a specific skill set, differentiating them from someone who just smashes a window impulsively.
So it's a technical skill combined with planning, not just force.
Yes, exactly. They possess the ability to plan, direct, and execute an operation. This isn't usually a spur-of-the-moment decision to break into a house or a business. It's often researched, perhaps even staked out, and definitely thought through.
So more like the professional thief again.
Very much so in that regard. They also need a certain business sense to quickly distinguish between valuable and worthless items during the burglary itself. They're not going to waste precious time on low-value items or things that are difficult to sell.
Time is critical once they're inside.
Absolutely. And crucially, just like the professional thief, they must have connections to dispose of the fruits of the crime.
Back to the fence again, the Achilles heel.
Back to the Achilles heel. This again highlights that common vulnerability of property crime, the illicit disposal of the stolen goods.
Right.
And the type of burglary committed, whether it's residential premises, maybe a safe burglary requiring specialized tools, a commercial establishment, or even a vehicle, can often offer significant clues to the suspect's identity and their modus operandi, because many burglars specialize.
So a safecracker might not be hitting houses and vice versa?
Often, yes. So you can see the significant overlap between the general burglar description and the characteristics of a professional thief, indicating how these categories interrelate. Often, burglars fit squarely into that professional spectrum due to their planning, skill, and disposal needs.
That was a really insightful look at the different kinds of individuals who commit property crimes and how their motivations shape their methods. Very clear distinctions. Now, let's shift our focus from taking things to breaking things.
Mm-hmm. Property damage.
Exactly. We're diving into a different part of our source material, Chapter 28, which covers direct crimes against property. It emphasizes that it's not just theft, but also damage and destruction. So beyond just taking things, what about breaking things?
Yeah, how does the law handle that?
We're going to explore how the law defines and punishes property damage, which can be just as impactful as theft, sometimes even more so, depending on what's damaged.
Absolutely. And this is where we get into the specifics of what property actually means in a legal context for these offenses. It's quite broad.
Okay, lay it out for us.
Our sources define property quite broadly.
Mm-hmm.
It includes real property, this land, and anything permanently attached, like buildings.
Right, like a house.
Tangible personal property, like a car or a television, something you can physically touch.
Your stuff.
Intangible personal property, which is more abstract, like stocks, copyrights, or even digital assets.
Interesting.
And importantly, anything severed from land, like timber or minerals, once they're removed. It also includes documents, including money, that represent or embody anything of value.
That's a very comprehensive definition. So it's not just physical items, but also things that represent value, like a contract, a check, or even, I guess, a sentimental photo, if you could argue its value.
Potentially, though valuing sentimental items is tricky. But yes, documents embodying value are definitely included. And here's a key nuance that comes up from the law, specifically Section 28.05. It's explicitly stated that having an interest in the property is not a defense to prosecution if another person also has an interest that the actor is not entitled to infringe upon.
Okay, unpack that. What does that mean in practice?
So you can't, for example, intentionally damage a car you co-own with your spouse and claim it's okay because you own half. If you're damaging it infringes on their legitimate half interest, you could still be prosecuted.
Oh, okay. That prevents people from damaging shared assets and claiming immunity simply because they have some form of ownership.
Exactly. It protects all parties with a legitimate interest.
That's a critical point. So if property is damaged or destroyed, how does the law actually determine the monetary extent of that damage? This seems crucial for figuring out how serious the crime is, right? Like, a scratch on a car is very different from a house burning down.
It absolutely is. And this section, Section 28.06 on pecuniary loss, is actually fascinating because it shows how the law tries to grapple with a very practical problem. How do you put a price tag on damage? It's not always straightforward.
Right.
For property that is completely destroyed, the law first looks at its fair market value at the time and place of destruction.
Okay, what it was worth right then.
That's the ideal measure, what someone would pay for it. However, if that fair market value cannot be ascertained, say, for a unique family heirloom or a custom piece of art, then the calculation shifts to the cost of replacing the property within a reasonable time after the destruction.
So even unique items have a calculable loss.
The law tries to ensure that. This ensures that even unique or irreplaceable items have a quantifiable loss that can be used for legal purposes.
Okay. And what about property that's damaged but not completely destroyed, like that car with a scratch versus a total wreck?
Right. If the property is merely damaged, the pecuniary loss is determined by the cost of repairing or restoring the damaged property within a reasonable time after the damage occurred.
Makes sense. The repair bill, basically.
Essentially, yes. It's a practical approach for partial damage, aiming to make the victim whole again. Now, for documents without an ascertainable market value, like evidence of a debt, say an IOU, the loss is the amount due and collectible at maturity, minus any satisfied portion. For other types of documents, it's defined as the greatest amount of economic loss the owner might reasonably suffer by virtue of the destruction or damage.
That sounds a bit more subjective. Greatest amount of economic loss.
It can be, but it tries to account for intangible but significant losses, like the destruction of a crucial business contract that could have led to future profits. It requires proof, of course.
So the law has various methods to calculate loss, even for things that don't have a clear price tag. It really highlights the legal system's pragmatism in trying to assign a concrete value. Mm-hmm. What happens if none of those methods work? Is there a fallback? Like, you just can't figure out the value.
Yes, there's a fallback. If the amount of pecuniary loss cannot be ascertained by any of the above criteria, it's legally deemed to be between $750 and $2,500.
Oh, interesting. A default range.
Exactly. This ensures a minimum threshold for the offense, preventing damage from going unpunished simply because it's hard to value precisely. It guarantees at least a Class A misdemeanor level if value can't otherwise be proven.
Okay.
Furthermore, if the person who caused the damage can prove they had a legal interest in the property or perhaps contributed some value to it, that value is deducted from the total loss. This ensures a degree of fairness where there's a shared interest or investment involved.
That seems like a very detailed and thoughtful framework trying to cover all the bases for valuation. And I know these pecuniary loss amounts are directly tied to the offense levels, right? Can you explain that value loss ladder chart and how it scales punishments? Because this seems fundamental to understanding the severity of a property crime.
Absolutely. It's the backbone of how these crimes are prosecuted and sentenced. This value loss ladder chart is the legal framework that directly ties the calculated monetary loss to the offense levels, escalating the severity of the charge as the financial damage increases. It's designed for proportionality.
Okay, walk us through it.
Sure. At the bottom, for a pecuniary loss of less than $100, the offense is a Class C misdemeanor. Think minor vandalism, maybe a small scratch.
Like a ticket, usually.
Often, yes. Then, if the loss is $100 or more but less than $750, it bumps up to a Class B misdemeanor.
Okay.
Between $750s and less than $2,500, it escalates to a Class A misdemeanor. This is often where more significant vandalism falls.
Getting more serious, potential jail time there.
Yes. Then we cross into felony territory. A loss of $2,500 or more but less than $30,000 is a state jail felony.
Okay, that's a big jump. State jail time is possible.
Definitely. Moving up, $30,000 or more but less than $150,000 is a third degree felony.
It's significant damage now.
$150,000 or more but less than $300,000 is a second degree felony.
We're talking major destruction.
And finally, $300,000 or more is categorized as a first degree felony. This is reserved for truly catastrophic property damage, like arson destroying a large building.
Wow. It really lays out a very clear path of escalating consequences based purely on the dollar value of the damage. Very predictable in that sense.
Exactly. It allows the legal system to apply proportionate penalties based on the quantifiable harm, acting as a clear deterrent.
Now let's get into some specific property crimes mentioned in Chapter 28. One of the most common ones we hear about is criminal mischief. What exactly does the law define as criminal mischief? It sounds pretty broad.
It is indeed a broad category, often considered the general breaking things or messing with stuff law. Section 28.03 defines it. A person commits criminal mischief if, without the effective consent of the owner, they intentionally or knowingly damage or destroy tangible property.
Okay, classic vandalism, smashing a window, keying a car.
Precisely. But it's more than just that. It also includes intentionally or knowingly tampering with tangible property, causing pecuniary loss or substantial inconvenience to the owner or a third person.
Tampering. So you don't even have to break it.
Right. Merely disabling a security camera without physically breaking it could be criminal mischief if it causes loss, maybe prevents catching another crime, or substantial inconvenience, like shutting down a business's security.
Okay, that's broader than I thought.
And importantly, it covers intentionally or knowingly making markings, including inscriptions, slogans, drawings, or paintings on tangible property. This is where graffiti often falls.
So, spray painting a wall, even if it cleans off easily.
Yes. These markings don't necessarily have to cause structural damage or cost a fortune to remove. The act of making the mark without consent is often enough, though the cost of removal will affect the penalty level via that value ladder.
So it's not just about destroying something, but also interfering with it or marking it up. It makes me think about, annoying pranksters or even activists who might spray paint a slogan somewhere.
Exactly.
And I see here that the general offense levels for criminal mischief follow that value ladder we just discussed based on the pecuniary loss. But there are special items or situations that can immediately elevate the offense level, regardless of the value, up to a certain point. What are some of those critical situations and why are they treated differently? This seems really important.
This is where the law really emphasizes the broader societal impact of the crime, not just the direct financial loss to one owner. The law prioritizes certain types of property because damaging them affects communities or critical services.
Okay, like what?
For example, simply causing substantial inconvenience through tampering can elevate an offense to a Class C or a Class A misdemeanor, depending on the specific context, even if the actual dollar loss is minimal. Think about someone intentionally, say, disabling a public phone or tying up an emergency line.
Right, the impact is bigger than the cost.
Exactly. But the charges become much more severe if the crime involves public services or critical infrastructure. For instance, impairment or interruption of a public water supply immediately becomes a Class A misdemeanor, regardless of the monetary loss. Clean water is essential.
Makes sense.
Damage to a habitation by a firearm or explosive weapon immediately jumps to a state jail felony. This reflects the serious threat to personal safety and the sanctity of the home.
Absolutely.
Damage to a fence specifically designed to contain livestock or game animals is also a state jail felony. This protects agricultural livelihoods and the significant investment in livestock.
Important for rural areas, especially.
Any impairment or interruption of flood control property, public utilities like gas, communications, transportation, or other essential public services is also a state jail felony. This underscores the profound importance of reliable public infrastructure for daily life. You cut a major fiber optic cable, that's a state jail felony. even if the cable itself isn't worth $2,500.
Because it disrupts potentially thousands of people.
Precisely. And look at this one, a newer addition reflecting crime trends. Damage or tampering with a motor vehicle during catalytic converter removal or attempted removal is a state jail felony.
Ah, yes, that's been a huge problem. Good to see it specifically addressed.
It shows the law adapting. Then, causing the death of cattle, bison, or horses by firearm or other weapon is a third-degree felony, again highlighting the economic value and perhaps cultural significance of large livestock.
Higher than just damaging a fence.
Yes. Also, impairment or interruption of access to an automated teller machine, ATM, is a third-degree felony impacting financial access.
Interesting.
And here's a very specific, almost extreme example showing potential catastrophic risk. Damage caused by introducing bovine spongiform encephalopathy, mad cow disease, to livestock is a first-degree felony.
Wow. Recognizing the massive economic and public health threat.
Absolutely. And lastly, damage to transportation communications equipment or devices, think railroad signals, airport systems, is a third-degree felony, crucial for public safety and commerce.
Wow. Those specific examples truly show how the law prioritizes certain assets and infrastructure. It's not just about the dollar amount, but the cascading impact on society or critical systems. It's like the law has a hierarchy of what's most vital.
That's a great way to put it, a hierarchy of protection. The law also includes a presumption of tampering for public utilities, like communications, water, gas, or power.
A presumption? What does that mean?
It means if the supply has been diverted from a meter or prevented from correctly registering or activated without a meter, it's presumed the person receiving the economic benefit knowingly tampered with it.
So if you're getting free electricity because the meter's bypassed, the law presumes you knew about it.
Essentially, yes. It aids in prosecution, where direct observation of the tampering might be difficult. The burden shifts slightly to the person benefiting.
That makes sense.
Furthermore, there's a concept of aggregation. If multiple items, even belonging to different owners, are damaged, destroyed, or tampered with as part of one scheme or continuing course of conduct.
Like a vandalism spree.
Exactly. The pecuniary losses from all the incidents can be added together, aggregated to determine a potentially higher offense grade.
So you can't just break 10 $100 windows and claim they're all separate Class C misdemeanors.
Correct. If it's part of one spree, that could add up to $1,000, making it a Class A misdemeanor based on the aggregated loss. It prevents criminals from simply breaking up their actions to stay under certain value thresholds.
That makes a lot of sense strategically for prosecution. Okay, moving on to a specific type of marking you mentioned under criminal mischief. Graffiti. It seems to have its own special section, almost like a subset, section 28.08.
It does. Graffiti is treated as a specific form of criminal mischief with its own definitions and, crucially, enhanced penalties in certain situations, likely due to its high visibility and public nuisance factor.
Right. So how is it defined?
The offense is committed if, without the effective consent of the owner, a person intentionally or knowingly makes markings on tangible property with paint, an indelible marker, or an etching or engraving device.
Okay, paint is obvious, but what's an indelible marker or etching device legally?
Good question. Aerosol paint is just what it sounds like. An etching or engraving device is any device that can make a mark or impression on property, regardless of what it was designed for. So a rock used to scratch glass counts.
Okay.
And an indelible marker is specifically defined as one using paint or ink formulated to be more difficult to erase, wash out, or remove than ordinary paint or ink. Think Sharpies or paint pens, not washable markers.
Got it. Distinguishes it from temporary stuff.
Yeah.
And the penalties, do they follow the same value ladder?
Generally, yes. The offense levels for graffiti usually follow the same pecuniary loss ladder as general criminal mischief. So if you spray paint a wall and it costs, say, $150 to clean, that's typically a Class B misdemeanor, just like if you caused $150 in other physical damage.
Okay, so the monetary damage still dictates the general severity. However, I recall there's a specific situation that can significantly elevate the charge for graffiti regardless of the exact value, right?
You're touching on a key point that, again, highlights societal priorities. There's a special circumstance that elevates the offense for graffiti. If the marking is made on a school, a higher education institution, a place of worship or human burial, a public monument, or a community center providing medical, social, or educational programs.
So places with significant public or sacred value.
Exactly. If graffiti occurs on one of those places and the pecuniary loss is between $750 and $30,000, it automatically becomes a state jail felony.
Wow, that's a huge jump. Normally, that value range would be a Class A misdemeanor.
It's a significant enhancement. This distinction emphasizes the law's particular concern for protecting these sensitive public, educational, and sacred properties, recognizing their importance to the community fabric.
Definitely sends a message.
And similar to general criminal mischief, if multiple items are marked under one scheme or continuing course of conduct, their pecuniary losses can be aggregated to determine a potentially higher offense grade, reinforcing the impact of a pattern of vandalism.
That distinction for sensitive public or sacred properties is very clear. Now, you also mentioned earlier a less severe form of damage, reckless damage or destruction, Section 28.04. What's the key difference there in terms of intent?
The key difference for reckless damage or destruction is the culpability standard, the mental state required. While criminal mischief requires acting intentionally or knowingly.
Meaning you meant to do it or were practically certain it would happen?
Right. This offense only requires acting recklessly. Recklessness means you were aware of, but consciously disregarded a substantial and unjustifiable risk that your actions would cause the damage.
Yeah.
You didn't necessarily mean to break it, but you acted in a way that showed a gross deviation from how a reasonable person would act, knowing the risk.
So less blameworthy than intentional damage.
Exactly. Because of this lower mental state, it's generally just a Class C misdemeanor, reflecting a lesser degree of culpability compared to deliberate acts of mischief.
Can you give an example?
Maybe doing donuts in a parking lot and recklessly slinging gravel that breaks a nearby window. You didn't aim for the window, but your reckless driving created the risk you ignored. If you intentionally threw a rock at it, that's criminal mischief.
Got it. It comes down to the mindset. I meant to do it versus I really should have known better and not done that.
That's a good way to put it.
Okay, finally, in this section on property damage, let's touch on a rather unique and potentially very dangerous property offense, interference with railroad property, Section 28.07.
It is indeed unique and critical due to the severe safety risks involved. First, the law clearly defines railroad property. It includes trains, tracks, bridges, signals, rights of way, work equipment, safety devices, the whole system. Tamper means to move, alter, or interfere with any of this property.
Okay, and what actions count as interference?
The offense covers two main types of actions. First, throwing objects or discharging a firearm or weapon at a train or rail-mounted work equipment.
That sounds incredibly dangerous, like something out of an old Western, but real life.
Extremely dangerous. This is generally a Class B misdemeanor. However, if this act causes bodily injury to anyone on board the train or equipment,
Uh-oh.
the offense escalates dramatically to a third-degree felony.
That's a huge jump in severity from a misdemeanor to a serious felony. It really underscores the extreme danger posed to passengers and crew.
Precisely. It reflects the potential for mass casualties from what might seem like a simple act of mischief. The second set of actions involves interference without the effective consent of the owner. This includes simply entering or remaining on railroad property, knowing that it is railroad property. That alone is a Class C misdemeanor.
Just being on the tracks or the railway land.
Yes. But then the penalties escalate rapidly based on the pecuniary loss ladder if one tampers with railroad property in a way that disrupts its function, places an obstruction on a railroad track or right of way, which could cause a derailment, or, most critically, causes in any way the derailment of a train, rail car, or other rail property that moves on tracks.
So messing with signals, putting stuff on the tracks, or actually causing a derailment.
These follow the same pecuniary loss ladder we discussed earlier, ranging from Class C misdemeanor for minimal loss all the way up to a first-degree felony for damages of $300,000 or more. The potential for a train derailment is so high risk, the law treats it with the utmost severity.
So simply being on railroad property without permission is an offense, but causing damage or obstructing a train can lead to major felony charges because of the catastrophic potential. Are there any defenses or exceptions for, say, railway workers doing their jobs?
Yes, there's an important defense built in. It's generally not an offense if the entry or actions are undertaken by railroad employees or labor representatives exercising rights under the Railway Labor Act, as long as they're acting within the scope of their employment or representation.
Okay, so legitimate workers are protected.
Correct. This ensures that legitimate work and union activities aren't penalized. Overall, the severe penalties reflect the vital safety risks associated with these offenses and why the law escalates penalties so dramatically with damage or injury. The potential for mass casualties, significant economic disruption, and massive property damage is just incredibly high.
Okay, we've covered a lot of ground on inanimate property, from understanding different types of thieves to the intricate ways the law defines and punishes damage. Very thorough. But now, let's shift our focus to a different category of property, one that's alive and often evokes strong emotions. Animals.
A very important area.
Moving from inanimate objects to living beings, the law also has robust provisions against harming animals. Chapter 42 seems to cover a lot, ranging from farm animals to those that serve us, and even regulating activities like organized animal fighting.
It does. It's a complex area reflecting evolving societal values about animal welfare.
This is an area many listeners feel very strongly about, and it's fascinating to see how the law tries to balance protection with practicality, like farming or research.
It's a constant balancing act. Let's start with cruelty to livestock animals, which falls under Section 42.09. The law provides very specific definitions here, showing a nuanced approach.
Okay, what's considered livestock?
A livestock animal includes the usual suspects: cattle, sheep, swine, goats, but also horses, ponies, mules, donkeys, and other hoofstock. It even includes domestic fowl like chickens and turkeys, and sometimes less common ones like emus or ostriches if they're commonly raised for consumption or agricultural purposes. It's basically any animal commonly associated with farming or ranching.
Got it. And how does it define cruelty?
It breaks it down. Abandon, for instance, means leaving an animal in your custody without making reasonable arrangements for its care by someone else. Cruel manner means causing or permitting unjustified pain or suffering. Torture is any act causing unjustifiable pain or suffering a higher standard. And there's even a specific definition for trip, which means using an object like a rope or wire to intentionally make a horse fall or lose its balance.
Tripping a horse, why is that specifically called out?
It relates to certain controversial rodeo-style events, sometimes called horse tripping, which animal welfare groups have campaigned against. The law here explicitly makes that specific action illegal outside of very limited exceptions.
Interesting. So the law is very clear on what constitutes livestock and what falls under cruel treatment. What are the specific actions considered cruelty under this section?
A person commits an offense if they intentionally or knowingly do any of the following: torture a livestock animal, unreasonably fail to provide necessary food, water, or care for an animal in their custody, unreasonably abandon a livestock animal, transport or confine a livestock animal in a cruel and unusual manner. Think overcrowded trucks in extreme heat with no water.
Horrible.
Administer poison to certain livestock, not cattle or horses, usually smaller stock, belonging to another without consent. Cause one livestock animal to fight with another. Use a livestock animal as a lure in dog race training or coursing.
Using a live animal as bait, that's awful.
It's explicitly illegal. Also, tripping a horse, as we discussed, or seriously overworking a livestock animal to the point of exhaustion or injury.
And how do the punishments for these actions vary? Is there a similar ladder to property damage?
The punishment varies significantly depending on the severity of the act and the offender's history. Most of the neglect-type offenses, failing to provide care, abandonment, cruel transport, seriously overworking, start as a Class A misdemeanor.
Okay.
However, if someone has two prior convictions under this section, or the section for non-livestock animals we'll discuss next, these can escalate to a state jail felony. Repeat offenders face harsher consequences.
Right. What about the more active cruelty, like torture?
Those are treated more severely from the start. Acts like torture, causing animals to fight, poisoning where applicable, or using live animals as lures are generally state jail felonies right off the bat.
No misdemeanor option there.
Correct. And with two prior convictions for those types of offenses, they become third-degree felonies. Tripping a horse is also generally a state jail felony.
So a clear escalation based on severity and history.
Yes. And it shows the law trying to draw lines between malicious acts, neglect, and necessary animal management. For instance, there's a specific defense for tripping a horse if it was done solely for identification purposes, like branding, or for providing veterinary care.
That's good that there are defenses for legitimate purposes. Are there broader exceptions for things like farming practices or scientific research, given that many of these animals are raised for food or study?
Yes, absolutely. That balance is crucial here. It's a defense if the actor was engaged in bona fide scientific research experimentation, as long as it adheres to accepted ethical guidelines.
Okay.
And critically, it's an exception if the conduct is a generally accepted and lawful practice related to fishing, hunting, trapping, wildlife management, or operating a shooting preserve as regulated by state and federal law.
So standard hunting isn't cruelty under this law.
Correct. This also extends to legitimate animal husbandry or agriculture practices involving livestock animals. This highlights the law's attempt to balance protecting animals from wanton cruelty with allowing for accepted agricultural or wildlife management practices that are considered necessary or standard.
So the law recognizes the realities of farming and wildlife control, but within very specific parameters designed to prevent needless suffering or abuse. That makes sense. Now, beyond livestock, what about other animals? Our pets, for example. How does the law protect them?
That's covered under Section 42.092, Cruelty to Non-Livestock Animals, which expands protections to a wider range of creatures. Here, an animal is broadly defined as a domesticated living creature. This includes pets, but also specifically mentions stray or feral cats or dogs.
Ah, so it protects strays too.
Yes. And it also includes any wild living creature previously captured. Importantly, it does not include uncaptured wild living creatures, which fall under wildlife laws, or livestock animals, which have their own section we just discussed.
Okay, so pets, strays, captured wildlife. What about programs like Trap, Neuter, Return for feral cats?
That's actually specifically addressed. This section defines a Trap, Neuter, Return program, TNR, as a non-lethal population control practice where an animal is humanely trapped, evaluated, vaccinated, sterilized by a vet, marked, like ear tipping, and then returned to the trap location. This shows the law adapting to modern animal welfare initiatives.
That's great. So this sounds like a much broader umbrella than just farm animals. What kinds of actions are covered here, and what's the mental state required? Is it still just intentional acts?
This section is broader in a couple of ways. First, it covers acts committed intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly.
Recklessly is included here too, like with property damage.
Yes. That inclusion of recklessly as a culpability standard makes it a more encompassing offense than many of the livestock cruelty offenses, where intent or knowledge is often required. It covers situations where someone maybe didn't mean to harm the animal, but their actions showed a conscious disregard for a substantial risk of harm.
Okay, so what actions are prohibited?
It's a fairly long list, covering severe abuse down to neglect. Actions include torturing an animal or cruelly killing or causing serious bodily injury, SBI, to an animal without the owner's consent, killing, administering poison to, or causing SBI to an animal, unreasonably failing to provide necessary food, water, care, or shelter. That shelter part is crucial for pets, especially in extreme weather.
Definitely. Leaving a dog chained outside in freezing rain or scorching heat.
Exactly. Also, unreasonably abandoning an animal, transporting or confining an animal in a cruel manner without consent, causing any bodily injury, not just serious, causing one animal to fight another if neither animal's a dog, because dog fighting has its own section, using a live animal as a lure in dog race training, or seriously overworking an animal.
Quite comprehensive. And the punishments for non-livestock animals, do they follow a similar escalation pattern?
Yes, similar to livestock, the punishments escalate significantly based on the act and history. Failing to provide care, abandonment, cruel transport, causing non-serious bodily injury, or seriously overworking an animal are generally Class A misdemeanors.
Okay.
These escalate to a state jail felony with two prior convictions under either this section or the livestock cruelty section. But for the more egregious acts like torture, cruel killing, causing SBI, or administering poison, these start as third-degree felonies.
Much higher starting point.
Yes. And these can escalate all the way to a second-degree felony with two prior convictions for these specific severe actions. Causing non-dog animals to fight or using live lures start as state jail felonies, becoming third-degree felonies with a prior conviction. The severity here really reflects society's increasing value placed on the well-being of companion animals and condemning severe abuse.
It certainly seems to. Are there similar defenses or exceptions as with livestock? I imagine there are, for things like humane euthanasia or maybe dealing with a dangerous stray.
You're right. There are necessary exceptions. It's a defense if the actor had a reasonable fear of bodily injury from a dangerous wild animal, you can protect yourself. Also, bona fide scientific research under ethical guidelines is generally protected. Standard exceptions apply for generally accepted and lawful forms of fishing, hunting, trapping, wildlife management, or agricultural practices. Specific defenses for abandonment include releasing or returning a stray or feral animal under a recognized trap, neuter, return program, provided proper veterinary care was involved.
Ah, so TNR is explicitly protected.
Yes. Or releasing a previously trapped wild creature back into the wild according to wildlife regulations. Additionally, it's a defense if the animal was discovered on someone's property in the act of injuring or killing livestock or damaging crops and was killed or injured at that time to stop the damage.
The farmer protecting their livelihood defense.
Essentially. or if the action was taken by a public servant or utility worker acting within the scope of their duties, for example, animal control dealing with an aggressive animal posing a public threat. This shows the law trying to navigate complex, real-world situations where harming an animal might, unfortunately, be necessary.
That covers a lot of ground for general animal welfare. Let's move on to animals specifically involved in public service. What about interference with police service animals? Section 38.151. This sounds like a very direct and important protection.
This is indeed a critical area, reflecting the vital role these animals, usually dogs or horses, play in law enforcement and public safety. A police service animal, PSA, is defined as a dog, horse, or other domesticated animal specially trained for use by a handler or rider who is a peace officer, corrections officer, or jailer.
Canine units, mounted patrol horses.
Exactly. The law also defines their area of control, which includes their vehicle, kennel, or pen, emphasizing their working environment. An offense is committed if a person recklessly does certain things.
Recklessly again, so not necessarily intentional malice, but dangerous carelessness.
Right. Actions include taunting, tormenting, or striking a PSA, throwing an object or substance at a PSA, interfering with or obstructing a PSA or its handler rider in a way that inhibits or deprives the handler of control, basically, stopping them from doing their job effectively.
Like grabbing the leash or spooking the horse.
Precisely. Also, releasing a PSA from its control area without permission, entering a PSA's control area without effective consent, including placing food or other objects in the area, which could distract or even poison the animal, injuring or killing a PSA, or engaging in conduct likely to injure or kill a PSA, such as administering poison or setting traps where the animal works.
These sound like very serious offenses, given the animal's roles in protecting officers and the public. What are the penalties for interfering with or harming a police service animal?
The penalties are indeed severe, reflecting the importance and the significant investment in training these animals. Taunting or tormenting a PSA is a Class C misdemeanor. Throwing something at one is a Class B. Interfering, releasing from control, or entering their control area are Class A misdemeanors.
Okay, misdemeanors for interference. What about injury?
That's where it jumps significantly. If the act involves injuring a PSA or engaging in conduct likely to injure, it's a state jail felony. But it escalates even further. If the conduct results in killing a PSA, or materially and permanently affects its ability to perform its duties, effectively ending its career, or involves conduct likely to kill or permanently injure it, it becomes a second-degree felony.
Extremely serious consequences. And I imagine there are financial penalties as well, considering the cost of training and care for these specialized animals.
Absolutely. Beyond the criminal penalties, the law mandates that convicted individuals be ordered to pay restitution to the agency that owns the animal.
Restitution for what, specifically?
It covers all related veterinary or medical bills, the often substantial cost of replacing the assistance animal if it's killed or permanently disabled, the cost of retraining an injured animal by a reputable organization if recovery is possible, and any other reasonable expenses incurred by the owner as a result of the offense.
So the offender pays to fix the harm they caused.
Exactly. These restitution orders ensure the full financial cost of the harm is borne by the offender, reinforcing the high value placed on these working animals, both for their service and the public funds invested in them.
So police animals are protected with serious penalties and restitution, and that makes perfect sense given their training and function. What about animals that assist people with disabilities, like guide dogs or service animals? How does the law protect them under Section 42.091?
That's covered under Attack on Assistance Animal. An assistance animal is specifically defined as one specially trained and equipped to help a person with a disability and actually used by that person. So it's not just any pet.
Right, a working animal.
An offense occurs if a person intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly attacks, injures, or kills an assistance animal. It also includes inciting or permitting an animal they own or have custody of, like their own pet dog, to attack, injure, or kill an assistance animal.
So if your off-leash dog attacks a guide dog, you could be liable?
Yes, if you recklessly allowed it to happen. The result must be that the assistance animal is actually attacked, injured, or killed.
What are the consequences for harming an assistance animal? This would be absolutely devastating for someone who relies on that animal for independence and daily life.
It would be, and the penalties reflect that profound impact. They are significant and directly tied to the level of harm caused to the assistance animal. If the actor or their animal merely attacks an assistance animal, meaning makes aggressive physical contact but maybe causes no lasting injury, it's a Class A misdemeanor.
Okay.
If the assistance animal is injured as a result of the attack, it escalates to a state jail felony.
Serious, Trump.
And if the assistance animal is killed, it becomes a third-degree felony.
Still very serious. And restitution.
Yes. Just like with police service animals, the court is mandated to order the defendant to pay restitution to the person with the disability. This covers veterinary or medical bills, the significant cost of replacing or retraining the animal, and any other reasonable expenses incurred because of the offense.
So again, making the victim financially whole.
Yes. It recognizes the direct and profound impact these crimes have on individuals with disabilities and their independence. These animals are often indispensable partners, providing mobility, safety, hearing assistance, or other vital support. Harming them is not just harming property, it's severely impacting a person's life.
The law clearly values these animals highly, understanding their unique and irreplaceable role. Now, let's move to something a bit different, but still involving animals. Organized cruelty. We're talking about the grim reality of organized animal fighting, specifically dog fighting, Section 42.2 out, and cock fighting, Section 42.105. These activities, unfortunately, have a long, often brutal history.
They do, and the law addresses them specifically and severely, recognizing the inherent cruelty and associated criminal activity. Let's start with dog fighting. The law defines it simply as any situation where one dog attacks or fights another, regardless of whether a serious injury occurs.
Doesn't have to be a fight to the death.
No. An offense is committed if a person intentionally or knowingly causes a dog to fight with another dog, participates in the earnings from, or operates a facility used for dog fighting, like renting out a barn, uses or permits their property to be used for dog fighting, owns or possesses dog fighting equipment, like training treadmills or break sticks, with the intent to use it for fighting, owns or trains a dog with the intent that it be used for fighting, or, importantly, attends as a spectator and exhibition of dog fighting.
So even just being present watching is a crime itself.
Yes. Attending as a spectator is a Class A misdemeanor. Owning or possessing the equipment or owning or training a dog for fighting are also Class A misdemeanors.
And the organizers.
The more central roles actually causing the dogs to fight, participating in the earnings, or operating the facility are state jail felonies.
Okay. Are there any defenses? Like, what if dogs just fight on their own?
There's a specific defense provided. It's a defense if a person caused a dog to fight another dog solely to protect livestock, other property, or a person from injury by the other dog, and for no other purpose. So breaking up a fight or defending property is okay.
Got it. Legitimate protection isn't criminalized.
Right. And interestingly, for prosecuting the organizers, a conviction for participating in earnings or operating a facility can be based on the uncorroborated testimony of another party to the offense, like another participant.
That makes it easier to prosecute the ringleaders, doesn't it? You don't need an outside witness.
It removes a potential barrier, yes. It's a notable provision.
That's a significant tool for law enforcement. Now, what about cockfighting, which is also specifically addressed? Is it treated the same way?
It's treated very similarly, but with its own specific definitions reflecting the unique tools and traditions, unfortunately, associated with it. A cock is defined as a male domestic fowl, a rooster. Then you have terms for the implements used. Gaff is an artificial steel spur attached to the cock's leg. Slasher is a curved knife blade also attached. And bridle is a device sometimes used in training.
Horrific implements designed to maximize injury.
Indeed. The offense is committed if a person knowingly causes a cock to fight with another cock, participates in the earnings of a cockfight, uses or permits property to be used for cockfighting, owns or trains a cock with the intent for fighting, manufactures, buys, sells, possesses, or advertises the implements like gaffs or slashers with intent for cockfighting, or attends as a spectator.
Very similar actions to dogfighting, just with roosters and their specific gear. Are the penalties different?
Slightly different at the lower end. For cockfighting, attending as a spectator is generally only a Class C misdemeanor, like a traffic ticket, unless the person has a prior conviction for attending, in which case it becomes a Class A misdemeanor.
Okay, a lower penalty for first-time spectators compared to dogfighting.
Yes. Using a facility, owning or training a cock for fighting, or manufacturing possessing the implements, are Class A misdemeanors. Causing cocks to fight or participating in the earnings are state jail felonies. Same as for dogfighting organizers.
Are there different defenses for cockfighting, maybe related to its historical ties to poultry breeding?
Yes, there are some specific affirmative defenses that acknowledge that history, though they're narrow. It's an affirmative defense if the conduct occurred solely for breeding cocks, For legitimate poultry shows where the cock is judged purely by physical appearance, or if it was incidental to collecting specific implements like gaffs or slashers as artifacts. However, these defenses are not available if there's any evidence of actual cockfighting occurring.
So you can't use "I'm just a breeder" as cover if you're actually fighting the birds.
Correct. Other general defenses apply, like bona fide scientific research or generally accepted agricultural animal husbandry practices, though fighting isn't generally accepted. There's also an exception for spectators who are 15 years of age or younger, recognizing they might be present without full understanding or culpability.
It's interesting how the law distinguishes between these two forms of animal fighting, particularly with those historical nuances for cockfighting, yet still clearly prohibits the fighting itself. Okay, finally, in this animal section, let's cover an extremely serious and disturbing category, bestiality, section 21.09.
This is indeed a deeply disturbing offense, treated with extreme gravity in the legal code, reflecting its abhorrent nature. A person commits bestiality if they knowingly engage in a wide range of sexual acts in contact with animals. The definitions are graphic, but necessary to be precise.
Okay.
This includes direct contact between the person's mouth, anus, or genitals, and the anus or genitals of an animal, or contact between the person's anus or genitals and the animal's mouth.
So specific sexual acts.
Yes. Also, fondly or touching the anus or genitals of an animal in a manner that is not a generally accepted or lawful animal husbandry or veterinary practice. This differentiates it from, say, a vet examining an animal or routine grooming. It includes touching through clothing.
Right. Context matters.
Also, causing an animal to contact the person's seminal fluid and inserting any part of a person's body or any object into the anus or genitals of an animal in a manner that is not a generally accepted and lawful animal husbandry or veterinary practice.
Very explicit prohibitions. Does it cover more than just the direct acts, like organizing this stuff?
Yes. The law extends much further to criminalize the entire enterprise surrounding these acts. It also includes those who possess, sell, transfer, purchase, or otherwise obtain an animal with the intent that it be used for any of these sexual acts, organize, promote, conduct, or participate as an observer of such conduct, cause or aid another person in engaging in such conduct, permit such conduct to occur on any premises under their control.
So facilitating it is also a crime.
Absolutely. And critically, engaging in such conduct in the presence of a child younger than 18 years of age, this significantly elevates the offense. Or advertising, offering, or accepting the offer of an animal with the intent that it be used for such conduct.
This is clearly a comprehensive effort to criminalize all aspects of this abusive behavior, recognizing the profound harm to the animal, which cannot consent, and the potential traumatic harm to any children exposed. What are the punishments for such a heinous act?
The standard punishment for bestiality is a state jail felony. However, it is elevated significantly to a second-degree felony if the offense is committed in the presence of a child younger than 18 years of age, or if the act results in serious bodily injury or death of the animal.
A very serious penalty, reflecting the gravity.
Absolutely. The severe nature of this offense is recognized by law as highly egregious. It underscores the strongest protections the law offers against the most extreme forms of animal abuse, exploitation.
We've covered a lot of ground on property damage and the various laws protecting animals, from neglect to extreme cruelty. Now, let's shift to something almost everyone encounters in some way. The concept of trespass, covered in Chapter 30. It seems simple, being where you shouldn't be, but it's more nuanced than that, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. The details matter a lot, especially regarding notice.
Right. Every property owner has the fundamental right to control who enters their land. But what exactly constitutes legal notice that you're trespassing? And in today's world, with evolving gun laws, what are the specific rules around firearms and private property? This feels like an area where people can easily get confused or run into trouble unintentionally.
It is. Understanding trespass begins with some fundamental definitions from Section 30.01 that set the stage for what kinds of places can actually be trespassed upon.
Okay, like what?
First, habitation. This means a structure or vehicle specifically adapted for the overnight accommodation of persons. It's broader than just a house.
How so?
It includes each separately secured or occupied portion, like an individual apartment unit within a building. And importantly, it also includes any structure appurtenant to or connected with it. Think of an attached garage, a fenced yard immediately next to the house, maybe even a porch. It covers the private living space.
Okay, so the whole immediate living area. What else?
Second, building. This refers to any enclosed structure intended for use or occupation, whether as a habitation or for things like trade, manufacturing, ornament, or any other purpose. So this covers everything from a retail store or an office building to a factory, a church, or even, say, a decorative gazebo in a park if it's enclosed.
Very broad. And vehicles.
Third, vehicle. This includes any device designed for propelling persons or property, cars, trucks, boats, airplanes, except those devices already classified as a habitation, like an RV someone is living in.
So you can trespass in a car, but it's distinct from trespassing in someone's RV home.
Exactly. Different categories, potentially different implications.
That clarifies the types of structures and conveyances. So what are the core elements of criminal trespass itself? Under Section 30.05, when does merely being on someone else's property cross the line into a crime?
Okay. Criminal trespass specifies that a person commits an offense if they enter or remain on or in another's property. This could be land, a recreational vehicle park, a building, an aircraft, or another vehicle, without effective consent, A&D. This "and" is crucial. Had noticed that the entry was forbidden, or received notice to depart but failed to do so.
Notice again, that seems to be the linchpin.
It absolutely is. You generally can't be prosecuted for criminal trespass if you didn't know or shouldn't have reasonably known that you weren't allowed to be there, or if you weren't clearly told to leave and refused. Ignorance isn't always an excuse in law, but here, lack of notice is a defense.
That's a key distinction. So it's about being on someone else's property without permission and either knowing you shouldn't be there from the start or being told to leave and refusing. What does entry mean legally, and what are the specific recognized ways someone receives that critical notice?
Good questions. For entry, the law specifies it means the intrusion of the entire body.
The whole body. So just reaching an arm over a fence isn't trespass entry.
Technically, under this definition for criminal trespass, no. Your whole body has to cross the boundary line. Now, as for notice, which is foundational to proving criminal trespass, there are several defined ways it can be given. This is where it gets very specific.
Okay, let's hear them.
One, oral or written communication from the owner or someone with apparent authority, like a security guard or manager. This is the most direct. Being told, get off my property, or receiving a formal written no trespass letter.
Fair enough.
Two, fencing or other enclosure that is obviously designed to exclude intruders or to contain livestock. A solid, unbroken fence, clearly signaled private property, keep out.
Visual notice. Makes sense.
Three, posted signs on the property or at the entrance to a building that are reasonably likely to come to the attention of intruders, clearly indicating that entry is forbidden. Your typical no trespassing signs.
The classic sign.
Four, this one's interesting. The presence of purple paint. Marks on trees or posts.
Purple paint.
Really? Yes. It sounds a bit odd, maybe, but it's a legally recognized form of notice, especially common in rural or forested areas where signs might be impractical or get damaged easily.
Huh. Are there rules about the paint?
Very specific rules. The marks must be vertical lines, at least 8 inches long and at least 1 inch wide. They have to be placed between 3 and 5 feet from the ground. And the spacing matters. No more than 100 feet apart on forest land, or no more than 1,000 feet apart on other types of land and readily visible.
Wow, that's incredibly specific. You'd have to know that rule to recognize it.
You would. But it provides landowners another recognized way to mark their boundaries legally.
Okay. What else counts as notice?
Five, the visible presence on the property of cultivated crops grown for human consumption that are under cultivation, being harvested, or marketable if harvested at the time of entry.
So walking through someone's cornfield that's clearly being farmed is trespass, even without a fence or sign.
Yes. The visible agricultural use itself provides notice that the land is private and not open for public entry. It implies ownership and purpose.
That's incredibly detailed. So a farmer doesn't necessarily need a no trespassing sign if their field is visibly full of crops ready for harvest. It really makes sense when you think about it. Now, given these various ways to provide notice, how do the punishment levels for criminal trespass vary? Is it always just a minor offense?
Not at all. The punishment levels are primarily based on the location where the trespass occurs and specific circumstances surrounding the act. They escalate significantly for more sensitive areas or if dangerous conduct is involved. The general offense for criminal trespass, the baseline, is a Class B misdemeanor.
Okay, standard unauthorized entry.
It's reduced to a Class C misdemeanor, a lower level if the offense is committed on agricultural land and within 100 feet of the boundary, or on residential land and within 100 feet of a protected freshwater area.
Why the reduction there? Seems odd.
The reasoning isn't explicit. but it might reflect a lower perceived threat or intent. When someone is just near the edge of a large rural property or near a waterway on residential land, perhaps making it more about boundary awareness than malicious intent.
Okay. When does it get more serious?
It becomes a Class A misdemeanor under several heightened circumstances. If committed in a habitation, someone's home, or a shelter center, like a domestic violence or homeless shelter, these are places demanding high privacy and safety.
Makes sense.
Also, Class A, if on a Superfund site, hazardous waste areas, danger, or in a critical infrastructure facility, which we need to define, or on property of a higher education institution, but only if the person has a prior conviction for trespassing at that same type of institution.
Dealing with repeat offenders on campus.
Yes. And, crucially, it's a Class A misdemeanor if the person carries a deadly weapon during the commission of the trespass, regardless of the location.
Weapon automatically bumps it up.
Yeah.
Got it.
Right. Or if the trespass occurs on the property of a general residential operation, operating as a residential treatment center, places like group homes or facilities for vulnerable individuals needing protection.
Okay, protecting vulnerable residents. Is there a felony level?
Yes. It elevates all the way to a felony of the third degree if the criminal trespass is committed during the course of a smuggling of persons offense. Specifically, when the actor is encouraging or inducing someone to enter or remain in the U.S. illegally by concealing, harboring, or shielding them from detection on that property.
Wow. Linking trespass directly to human smuggling makes it a felony.
Exactly. It targets the use of property in furtherance of that specific federal crime.
So the law assigns greater gravity to trespass in places like homes, hazardous sites, critical utilities, or when a weapon is involved, or tied to other serious crimes. It really highlights what society deems most vulnerable or vital. Can you elaborate on what exactly constitutes a critical infrastructure facility? You mentioned that needs definition. It sounds important and precise.
It is indeed a very precise and important definition. A critical infrastructure facility means one of several specific types of facilities, but only if they are completely enclosed by a fence or other physical barrier that is obviously designed to exclude intruders. That enclosure is key.
Okay, so it has to be fenced off properly. What kind of places count?
The list includes a chemical manufacturing facility or a refinery, an electrical power generating facility, substation, switching station, control center, or transmission distribution facility. Basically, the power grid infrastructure.
Vital.
A water intake structure, water treatment facility, wastewater treatment plant, or pump station. Vital for public health. A natural gas transmission compressor station, or the liquid natural gas, LNG, terminal or storage facility. Energy infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
A telecommunications central switching office, think major phone internet hubs.
Yeah.
A port, railroad switching yard, trucking terminal, or other freight transportation facility. Key for commerce and supply chains. A gas processing plant. Or a transmission facility used by a federally licensed radio or television station.
A pretty comprehensive list of things society relies on heavily.
Absolutely. The law clearly designates these properties as more sensitive due to their vital role in public services, economic stability, and even national security, leading to those higher Class A misdemeanor penalties for trespass. The physical barrier requirement emphasizes that clear, unmistakable notice is given that entry is forbidden.
That makes sense. These are the arteries of modern society, so any interference is treated seriously. Now, are there any exceptions for, say, peaceful protest or assembly at these places, especially since some, like ports or maybe university campuses, are kind of quasi-public facing? Could protesters be hit with these higher penalties?
That's a really important point. And yes, the law does try to strike a balance with First Amendment rights. If the state seeks that increased punishment for trespass on a higher education property or a critical infrastructure facility, the defense can argue at trial that the defendant was actually engaging in constitutionally protected free speech at the university, or that their entry or remaining at the critical infrastructure facility was part of a peaceful or lawful assembly, maybe even related to exercising state or federal labor law rights.
So a specific defense for protesters.
Yes. If the defendant can prove this by a preponderance of the evidence, meaning it's more likely true than not, then that punishment increase to Class A would not apply. They might still be guilty of the basic Class B trespass, but not the enhanced penalty.
That's a crucial balance between security and constitutional rights. It prevents laws meant to deter criminals or saboteurs from inadvertently stifling legitimate protests or labor actions.
Precisely. It's an important safeguard.
Okay, yeah. Let's talk about a specific and often contentious area of trespass, firearms and private property. With open and concealed carry laws being what they are, What are the specific rules around firearms postings and trespass by license holder? Sections 30.05, 30.06, 30.07 look really detailed. This seems like it could get confusing very quickly for both property owners and gun owners.
It definitely can, because it layers firearms regulations directly onto property rights, and it requires very, very specific forms of notice. First, the law outlines the requirements for firearms postings under 30.05C. These are the general signs a property owner can use to prohibit any firearm, not just handguns carried by license holders.
Okay, a general no-gun sign. What makes it legally binding for trespass?
For such a sign to be legally effective in providing notice for a criminal trespass prosecution related to carrying a firearm, it must be incredibly precise. It must include language identical or substantially similar to, pursuant to Section 30.05, Penal Code, criminal trespass, a person may not enter this property with a firearm.
Wow, exact wording required.
Or substantially similar. It has to convey that specific legal authority. It must be in both English and Spanish. The text must appear in contrasting colors with block letters at least 1 inch in height, so it's easily readable. And it must be conspicuously displayed and clearly visible to the public at each entrance to the property.
So a tiny handwritten sign probably doesn't cut it legally for this purpose?
Likely not. The specificity is key to ensuring clear, undeniable notice that firearms are prohibited under this specific statute. If a sign doesn't meet all those requirements, it might not be legally sufficient notice for a Section 30.05 firearm trespass charge.
That level of specificity is surprising but important for clarity. Now, how does this relate to the actual offense? Is it always a serious charge if you carry past one of these signs?
Not necessarily. There's a specific subsection, 30.05D-3, for criminal trespass with a firearm. If a person enters property carrying a firearm, and the sole reason their entry was forbidden was because firearms were prohibited by a proper 30.05 sign.
So they weren't trespassing for any other reason.
Right. Then it's only a Class C misdemeanor with a fine not exceeding $200. It's a relatively low-level offense, treated more like a violation of the posting rule.
Okay, that's less severe than I might have expected.
However, if after entering, the actor personally received notice, maybe security told them directly, "Sir, you can't have that firearm here, you need to leave," and then they failed to depart, it escalates to a Class A misdemeanor.
So it's about ignoring the sign versus actively refusing to leave after being told personally. That makes sense. Now, what about people with a license to carry a handgun, LTC? There are two whole separate sections, 30.06 and 30.07, specifically for trespass by license holder. How are these different?
Yes, these are very distinct offenses designed specifically for individuals who hold a Texas LTC, recognizing their general legal right to carry a handgun, but still allowing property owners to restrict that carry on their specific premises if they choose. Section 30.06 deals with trespass by license holder with a concealed handgun.
Okay, concealed carry.
An LTC holder commits this offense if they carry a concealed handgun onto another's property without effective consent, and they receive notice that entry with a concealed handgun was forbidden.
And how is notice given for this specific purpose? Is it the same 30.05 sign?
No, this requires a different specific notice. Notice under 30.06 can be given orally by the owner or someone with authority, or through written communication. That written communication can be a card or document the owner provides, OR more commonly, a specific sign. This sign, often called a 30.06 sign, has its own precise requirements. It must contain language identical or substantially similar to, pursuant to Section 30.06 Penal Code. A person licensed under Subchapter H, Chapter 411 Government Code, Handgun Licensing Law, may not enter this property with a concealed handgun. It also needs to be in English and Spanish, contrasting colors, block letters at least 1 inch high, and displayed conspicuously.
So a completely separate sign specifically mentioning concealed handguns and the license law.
Correct. A general no guns or 30.05 sign is not sufficient notice to prohibit a licensed individual from carrying concealed under 30.06. You need the specific 30.06 notice.
Wow, okay. And the penalty for violating 30.06?
If proper notice was given, usually via the sign, it's a Class C misdemeanor, fine up to $200. However, just like with the general firearm trespass, if the license holder was personally given oral notice to depart after entering and failed to do so, it becomes a Class A misdemeanor.
Same escalation based on ignoring a direct oral warning. Now, what about openly carried handguns? That's Section 30.07, right? Is it parallel?
Exactly parallel. Section 30.07 covers trespass by license holder with an openly carried handgun. The offense is the same structure. an LTC holder carrying openly on property without consent after receiving notice that entry with an openly carried handgun was forbidden.
And does this require yet another specific sign?
Yes. Notice under 30.07 must be oral or written, with the written sign, the 30.07, containing language identical or substantially similar to, pursuant to Section 30.07, Penal Code. A person licensed under Subchapter H, Chapter 411, Government Code, Handgun Licensing Law, may not enter this property with a handgun that is carried openly. Same requirements. English-Spanish, 1-inch contrasting block letters, conspicuous display.
So a property owner who wants to prohibit both concealed and open carry by license holders needs to post both a 30.06 sign and a 30.07 sign.
That is generally the requirement for effective statutory notice, yes. The penalties for violating 30.07 are identical to 30.06. Class C misdemeanor for violating the sign, Class A misdemeanor if you refuse to leave after being told orally.
Okay. Is there any confusion about what openly carried means? Like, what if it's in a holster?
The law specifically addresses that to avoid ambiguity. Section 30.07 explicitly states it is not a defense to prosecution under this section that the handgun was carried in a holster.
Ah, so even if holstered, if it's visible, it counts as open carry for the purpose of this sign, and the sign applies.
Correct. It clarifies that holstered open carry is still subject to the 30.07 prohibition if proper notice is given. So even if you're a licensed carrier, a property owner retains the right to prohibit handguns concealed, open, or both, provided they give the very specific, legally defined notice required by these statutes.
That's a really important clarification for licensed carriers. So while you generally have a right to carry, a private property owner also has a right to restrict that carry on their premises, provided they follow these strict rules for notification using the correct signs or communication.
Exactly. It's a balance of rights, heavily dependent on proper notice.
Now, are there any defenses or exceptions for licensed carriers under 30.06 or 30.07, perhaps related to where they live or specific professions like police officers?
Yes, there are several important defenses and exceptions built into both 30.06 and 30.07, recognizing situations where a blanket prohibition would be unreasonable or conflict with other rights. It's an exception if the property is owned or leased by a governmental entity, like a city park or state agency office, unless it's a specific premises where carrying is always prohibited by a different law, Section 46.03, like schools, courts, polling places, correctional facilities, etc.
So you generally can carry licensed handguns on most government property, even if they tried to post a 30.06307 sign?
Generally, yes, unless it falls under the 46.03 prohibited places list. The government can't typically use 30.06307 signs to override the license on general government property.
Okay, what else?
It's a defense if the license holder is volunteer emergency services personnel, like a volunteer firefighter or EMT who is carrying a handgun while on duty. It's also a defense for a licensed first responder, paid police, fire, EMS, who holds an unexpired certificate, is actively engaged in their duties, and is employed or supervised by a municipality or county. This protects emergency personnel responding to calls.
Makes sense.
And as mentioned, a general defense applies if the license holder was personally given oral notice to leave and promptly departed from the property. Complying with a direct request is a defense.
Right. Don't argue, just leave.
Essentially. And crucially, there are extensive defenses specifically protecting residents and guests in certain types of housing. Owners or tenants of condominiums, residents of leased premises, apartments, residents of manufactured home lots, or guests of hotels. These individuals can generally carry or store a firearm or ammunition in their own dwelling units or hotel rooms, or carry directly en route between their dwelling room and their vehicles in designated parking areas.
Even if the apartment complex or hotel lobby has 30.0630.07 signs posted.
Yes, those signs generally cannot prevent residents or guests from possessing firearms within their private units' rooms or going directly from their cars, provided they are not otherwise prohibited by law from possessing a firearm, like being a convicted felon.
So, your right to possess a firearm in your own home or temporary lodging is largely protected, even if the general property tries to restrict carry through signage. That makes a lot of sense, acknowledging the unique nature of private residences.
Precisely. It balances the property manager's rights over common areas with an individual's rights within their own domicile. Finally, it's important to note a broad non-applicability clause in Section 30.05I that also impacts 30.06 and 30.07. These firearm trespass laws do not apply to peace officers from Texas or federally recognized states or special investigators carrying authorized weapons, even if they're off duty, if the sole reason their entry was forbidden was because they were carrying the weapon.
So law enforcement can generally carry their weapons onto posted property without violating these specific trespass laws?
Correct. This ensures officers can carry as needed for public safety and their duties without being tripped up by these specific signage rules aimed at civilians. This whole area really highlights the intricate dance between individual Second Amendment rights, private property rights, and public safety concerns, where very specific signage, location, and circumstances dictate what's legal and what's not. It's truly complex. #TagTagGaltra.
Wow. We have certainly covered a vast landscape today. We've gone from the distinct motivations and methods of different types of criminals, the professionals, the semi-pros, the street thieves, the burglars.
Understanding the who.
To the intricate legal definitions of property damage, tracking how value determines severity through that ladder system, and how certain properties get special protection.
Right, the hierarchy of protection.
Then we moved into the comprehensive laws protecting animals, livestock, pets, strays, police canines, assistance animals from neglect, cruelty, fighting, and even bestiality.
A really important section reflecting societal values.
And finally, navigating the detailed nuances of trespass, focusing heavily on that crucial element of notice, and unpacking the very specific rules for firearms on private property, including those 30.06 and 30.07 signs.
Yeah, the signage rules alone are incredibly specific.
It really shows this isn't just about abstract legal codes. It's about the daily fabric of our communities, how we define boundaries, protect our assets and infrastructure, ensure public safety, and even how we relate to and care for living beings. It's truly foundational stuff for navigating our world.
Absolutely. And if we connect this all to the bigger picture, it's clear that these laws, detailed as they are, aren't just designed to punish after the fact.
Yeah.
They aim to deter negative behavior, to clearly define responsibility, and ultimately to protect what society collectively values.
Yeah.
They really reflect societal priorities regarding ownership, safety, the integrity of public services, and the ethical treatment of animals.
Yeah.
Understanding these distinctions, even at a high level, is fundamental for civic awareness and, frankly, for personal safety and responsibility.
Knowing your rights and the rules.
Exactly. It allows you to grasp the complexities of property rights, the gravity of various offenses, and the underlying rationale behind this legal framework that governs our interactions with the physical world and the living creatures within it. And remember, these laws aren't static. They adapt, like we saw with catalytic converters or TNR programs, as our society evolves and faces new challenges.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into property and trespass offenses. It's been an incredibly informative journey through these vital aspects of the law, hopefully helping all of you listening become more well-informed citizens.
It's been a pleasure. And as you reflect on all these detailed provisions protecting critical infrastructure like power grids and water supplies, specific types of fences for livestock, the heightened penalties for harming service animals, the precise rules for posting signs, it perhaps raises a final thought to consider. Given these very specific legal protections for tangible assets, essential services, and certain animals, how do these detailed frameworks reflect the shifting priorities and maybe the perceived vulnerabilities of our modern society? And looking forward, as new technologies like drones, digital assets, or even genetic information emerge, how might the very definition of property and trespass need to evolve? What new vulnerabilities will arise, and what new ethical considerations will we face in deciding how to protect what we value in the future?